Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is supported by Athletic Greens. With one scoop of AG1 in cold water, you're covering your day's nutritional bases and supporting your long-term gut health. With 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, probiotics, and adaptogens, AG1 supports your immune system, energy, aging, and focus. And it's less than $3 a day. Get the nutritional insurance your body craves while starting a daily habit you'll actually enjoy. Visit athleticgreens.com/BFC for a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase.
Introducing Self, a new show about real people who are challenging their relationship to money to build a better future for themselves.
My new focus is like, as these good things happen in my life, I want to be able to enjoy them.
Their loved ones.
Nah, like, I really don't want my daughters out here wanting for nothing. Now it's kind of backfired because now they really don't have no respect for me.
And their communities.
I want to create more services where women can feel supported when they don't have support.
Self is live now with new episodes every Wednesday. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 12th of January. Russia has again replaced its military commander in Ukraine, handing direct control of the stalled invasion to the nation's top general. Brazil is on high alert as Bolsonaro supporters call for further protests just days after the storming of the capital.
There are rows and rows of black cars with armed police. They are the Força Nacional, military police who have been brought in to protect the capital.
And a suicide bomb attack outside the Afghan foreign ministry in Kabul has caused heavy casualties. Also in the podcast, Britain calls on Iran not to execute a dual national who once served in a reformist Iranian government. And
it's basically landed in a branch of Waitrose, hasn't it, really, and is working its way down the aisles. So I'm sure it's incredibly happy.
The seal eating its way through a lake brimming with fish. After Ukraine's stunning victories in Kharkiv in September, Russia appointed a new battlefield commander, General Sergei Surovikin. Known as the Butcher of Syria for his brutal tactics there, he was hailed by Russian nationalists as a tough leader who could take the battle to the Ukrainians. However, after a second big Russian retreat in Kherson and painfully slow progress elsewhere, he has now been demoted, with Russia's top general, Valery Gerasimov, put in direct charge of the faltering invasion. The change in command comes despite Russian claims of advances in the east. With the latest on the battle for control of the salt mining town of Soledar, here's our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse.
The situation in Soledar depends on who you ask. It's under control as of this morning, according to this Ukrainian commander. They will never break us, says his injured comrade. We are winning. But if you ask these two, Russian, yes, but not from the regular army. They're from a private military group called Wagner, a network of mercenaries who do a lot of Russia's fighting. Its boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin, has recently recruited convicts from Russian jails, and they've been spearheading the attack on Soledar, claiming to now be in full control. We chat to one Ukrainian soldier on the front to see if that's the case.
Don't believe Russian propaganda. It's not true. Bakhmut and Soledar have Ukrainian control.
Kyiv has described the battle for Soledar and Bakhmut as the bloodiest scenario yet.
James Waterhouse. Well, on Wednesday, Yevgeny Prigozhin again claimed that Wagner had taken Soledar, inflicting heavy casualties on the Ukrainians, though President Zelensky had said fighting was continuing. But how important is Soledar anyway for the Russians? A question I put to Jonathan Marcus, a defence analyst from Exeter University.
Well, it's a very brutal attritional struggle, not just in Soledar, but 10 kilometres to the southwest, the bigger town of Bakhmut, which has been a huge focus of Russian attention over recent weeks. The Russians seem to be making some progress. Wagner mercenaries do look as though they've reached the centre of Soledar from the east, but they seem to have been held back to the north and the south of the town. And certainly earlier on today, it looked as though the Ukrainians were holding on. Now, if the Russians do take Soledar, and even if they were able to push on and take Bakhmut, it would probably be something of a Pyrrhic victory. They've expended huge, huge numbers of men in these assaults for towns which are in themselves not of huge strategic importance. And I think what you see here is a kind of battle between the Wagner mercenaries, their leadership, and the regular military leadership in Russia to try and prove that one or the other can actually secure something that looks like a victory on the ground.
What do you make of this change with the top man, putting the chief of staff, Valery Gerasimov, in direct control of the invasion?
Well, look, Russian command throughout this conflict has been a kind of process of musical chairs. It began with disparate commanders for the different battle fronts, no real clear organization pulling them all together. And more recently, of course, just 3 months ago, you had this new guy, General Sirovikin, put in overall charge. He has now been demoted effectively. He continues to command as a group of three lower commanders, but under the chief of the general staff himself, General Gerasimov. I think this shows, again, it reflects something of the political battles in Moscow. But I think also it indicates perhaps that we are looking towards the spring and a new Russian offensive. It's a poison chalice for General Gerasimov. If he fails now, I very much doubt that his future will be secure and he may find himself in turn pushed aside.
Defence analyst Jonathan Marcus. There is heightened security in Brazil after supporters of the far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro called for new protests, just days after the storming of Congress in the capital, Brasilia. Police across Brazil have been ordered to prevent roadblocks and the invasion of public buildings. Hundreds have been arrested for taking part in Sunday's unrest. Nomi Iqbal is in Brasilia and spent time outside a police station where people have been held.
Defiance and anger from some of the people detained following the attack on Brazil's capital. They're being bussed out of the police academy after being held here since Sunday. They shout, "We have the victory, our flag will never be red." More than 1,500 people have been questioned. Some have been released, others have been officially arrested and taken for further questioning. Telma's come all the way from Sao Paulo. Her friends are inside. She claims they've been wrongfully accused and that they've been set up.
It was a trap, you know, because when people got there at the demonstration, they were already left-wing people there, breaking everything.
Questions are being asked about the conditions inside the facility. Some lawmakers loyal to the former President Bolsonaro have turned up outside demanding answers. Nilcimar Fraga is the member of the Chamber of Deputies.
We heard about mistreatment, lack of food and people feeling sick. We came to check to see what is fact and what is rumor in this whole situation. So we are creating a commission because Parliament should follow up and give people answers.
Security has really tightened up in this sprawling city. I'm standing near a main road leading to Congress, and there are silver metal fences that go all the way round to protect the area. There are rows and rows of black cars with armed police. They are the Força Nacional, military police, who have been brought in to protect the capital. And for good reason, there are groups loyal to the former president, Bolsonaro, who are continuing to call for what they describe as an act to retake the power.
There's now a new head of public security here in Brasilia. Ricardo Capelli has taken over from Anderson Torres. Brazil's judicial authorities have ordered his arrest.
You have been brought in to take charge after this extraordinary failure in security, and there are also investigations that this could have been orchestrated. how are you making sure this doesn't happen again? And my other question is, what would be your message to anybody out there who's thinking of carrying out another attack?
Nunca mais a capital federal verá o que aconteceu.
The federal capital will never again see what happened. With regard to those who intend to repeat it, what I have to say is simple. They will be treated with the rigor of the law.
Anderson lives here. He says the security in Brasilia is necessary and wants rioters punished. President Lula is moving fast to show Brazil's democracy under him isn't fragile. He has called for rioters to be prosecuted with terrorism charges, fired many top security officials, and secured international support from world leaders.
Nomia Iqbal reporting from Brazil. A British Iranian man who was once a senior figure in the Iranian government could be executed within hours, accused of spying for the UK, something he denies. Alireza Akbari served as deputy defence minister under the reformist President Mohammad Khatami, but he was arrested in 2019 and convicted of spying. He's thought to retain links to a senior figure in the current Iranian regime. But there are fears he could be facing his final hours, as I heard from Parham Gobadi of the BBC Persian Service.
We talked to his wife in the morning and she said that they were told to have the final meeting with him and he was transferred to solitary confinement. So they are concerned that he might get hanged tomorrow morning. During the interview, she said that the confessions were made under duress and he was tortured in prison. Then during the day, a few hours ago, we managed to obtain an audio file from him when he was talking to his wife earlier. In there, he says that Iranian intelligence community, they tried to arrest him in 2018. According to him, that plot was foiled by influential figures. But in late 2019, he was finally detained and he was accused of spying for MI6, British intelligence. And in the audio file, he also says that Iranian intelligence community says he obtained top secret Iranian intelligence from Iran's National Security Council chief, Ali Shamkhani, in exchange for a bottle of perfume and a shirt.
Now, the arrest was 3 years ago. That's why correct. Are we getting the order for his execution now? I mean, there are talks of links between him and influential figures in previous governments.
What we know is that he was sentenced to death a few months ago, and his wife told us that they were talking to really senior Iranian judiciary officials, and they promised them that he would be released soon. And then she says in the past 48 hours, tables turned and everything changed, so they were shocked. And that's why they chose not to talk to the media and not to reveal the case.
But now they have. I mean, what do you think could be behind this?
There are several scenarios. One is the rivalry between the two Iranian intelligence branches. One of them is the government and the other one is the Revolutionary Guards. This is one scenario. The other one is that he was sentenced to death a few months ago after the start of the protests, when the protests swept the country in Iran. And we know that Iran has been accusing the United Kingdom of fomenting unrest in the country. Iranian hardliners have been to UK's embassy in Tehran, writing graffitis on the wall and saying down with the United Kingdom. They've been projecting Iranian missile factory on the walls of British embassy. So they're accusing the UK for the protest. Is this a kind of leverage they are using? We don't know, but we are not sure if it's they're 100% linked.
Parham Gobadi of the BBC Persian Service. The Taliban in Afghanistan say at least five people have been killed and others injured in a suicide attack near the Foreign Ministry building in Kabul. Images on social media showed casualties lying in the street. One official said the number of dead may be as high as 20. The Islamic State militant group said it carried out the attack. With more details, here's our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
An official at the Taliban-run information ministry said the suicide bomber had planned to enter the foreign ministry building but failed. An eyewitness said he saw a man with a shoulder bag and an assault rifle walking past before he blew himself up. The Taliban tend to underplay casualty figures in such incidents. Reports said a Chinese delegation was due to hold talks with the Afghan Taliban officials inside the Foreign Ministry building at the time of the attack. The latest incident will be seen as a big security lapse, a daring suicide bombing in a heavily protected zone where there are some foreign embassies are also situated. The Taliban claim to have improved security since storming back to power in August 2021, but the Islamic State militant group has carried out several bombings against the Taliban and on civilian targets over the last year. Five Chinese nationals were injured when gunmen attacked a hotel popular with Chinese business people last month.
Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etirajan. It was one of the biggest financial scandals in history. The Dubai-based Abraj Group managed assets worth $14 billion. Its boss, Arif Naqvi, persuaded the likes of Bill Gates and many Western governments to invest while promising to end world poverty. But all was not as it seemed, as Rachel Wright explains.
Arif Naqvi was very well connected. He was a regular at the World Economic Forum in Davos. John Kerry spoke at his investor conferences and Tina Turner sang at them. Mr. Naqvi was even consulted by the UN Secretary General on how to end world poverty. He promised his investors that he would build hospitals, power and food companies in some of the world's poorest countries and make them money. Simon Clark is a journalist at the Wall Street Journal.
He told his investors that by doing these investments, he would make profit for them, and at the same time, he could help end poverty in those countries by providing services and creating jobs. That's a very seductive proposition. You know, he's offering to make people money at the same time as ending poverty. What's not to like about that? If it works, great. A lot of people believed Arif and gave him billions of dollars.
But then Simon Clark was given a tip-off that a large amount of money from a hospital fund had gone missing.
Hundreds of millions of dollars, which should have gone into investments, were being secretly siphoned out of funds and used to spend on bonuses, salaries, running the firm, high living.
Simon Clark published a story which prompted investors to panic. And in 2018, in the largest collapse of its kind, the private equity group Abraj went under, losing its investors around $1 billion. Arif Naqvi tells us what happened next.
On the 10th of April 2019, the aircraft I was in, British Airways, landed from Islamabad, Pakistan. I'd been doing that flight pretty much every week for the last maybe 6 months. An announcement that I'd heard many times on aircraft before was made on the plane, which was, everybody please remain seated because the police want to come on board. But I didn't give it a second thought. As soon as I got off the plane, on the gangway, there was another gentleman. This one was dressed in a police uniform, and he said, "Sir, I'm placing you under arrest under an extradition warrant from the United States, and you need to come with us."
Mr. Naqvi recorded himself under house arrest in his home in London while awaiting charges of fraud and racketeering, and hasn't spoken publicly since his arrest. The BBC has obtained videos recorded by Mr. Naqvi himself. He strenuously denies any wrongdoing.
"I am crystal clear in front of my maker that I have never committed an intentional act of criminality."
If the trial in the US goes ahead, Mr. Naqvi could face 291 years in prison.
Rachel Wright. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
Good afternoon, Evan.
Why Morse code is making a comeback. The head of Turkey's medical association has been convicted of spreading propaganda for terrorists. Dr. Şebnem Korur Fincancı had called for an investigation into claims the Turkish army used chemical weapons against Kurdish militants, which the government denies. She was jailed for 2 years and 8 months, but has now been released while she appeals. From Istanbul, Ola Gerin reports.
Human rights activists in Turkey have grown accustomed to courtrooms and prison cells under the increasingly authoritarian rule of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The head of the Turkish Medical Association, Dr. Şebnem Korur Fincancı, is just the latest in the dock. Rights organisations say the trial was an attempt to silence the renowned forensic expert and anyone else who dares to question the government. She has now been freed, but her organisation is facing separate court proceedings. In Turkey, it pays not to speak out. Under a new disinformation law, those accused of spreading false news can be jailed for up to 3 years. With parliamentary and presidential elections due in the coming months, there are fears of an even greater crackdown on free speech.
Oleg Erin in Istanbul. The Church of England has announced the creation of a $120 million fund to, quote, address the past wrongs of slavery, after a report revealed much of its vast wealth originated from the slave trade. Gareth Mostyn is chief executive of the Church Commissioners, which manages a $12 billion church investment fund.
That's now a source of real shame for us and for which we apologise. But what's important for us now with this response that we're announcing today is about how we can invest in a better future for all, particularly for those communities who were deeply impacted.
David Olusoga, historian and broadcaster, told my colleague Michelle Hussain more about the church's finances.
Well, the Queen Anne Bounty was a laudable attempt to help the lives of members of the clergy who were suffering financially, who didn't have a proper income. The problem is that very quickly, the source of income became the South Sea Company, which was founded in 1711. And between 1714 and 1739, the main activity of the South Sea Company was slave trading. Now, today, the South Sea Company is famous for the South Sea Bubble, the great financial disaster of the early 18th century. But what's been forgotten is that it was a slave trading entity. It was providing enslaved Africans to the Spanish colonies in the New World.
And it would have been perfectly clear to those investing what it involved, the actual nuts and bolts of the trade, and indeed the loss of life along the way.
There was no question. People understood the savagery of the slave trade, the extreme details. They were to be later revealed by the abolitionist movement. But people investing in the South Sea Company understood that it was celebrated at the time that Britain had won the contract to transport enslaved people to the Spanish colonies in the New World. The other form of income is benefactions, money that came from people who were themselves involved in the Atlantic slave trade. And one of those benefactors was Edward Colston, whose statue was toppled in Bristol in 2020, who left money to the Queen Anne Bounty.
I see. And is this the first time that the church has really faced up to this, or have there been any previous efforts? And do we know how much money they made from it?
The piece of research that was published in a report yesterday is a very serious piece of academic work of forensic accountancy, and they attempt converting some of these historic sums. One way of looking about this is that the amount of money that the church received is around £1 billion in today's money.
A billion?
Yeah.
So the money that they're putting into this new fund to address past wrongs is £100 million, and they're saying that it will go to communities affected by slavery rather than to individual descendants as reparations. What do you think of that approach?
I think it's an enormous step forward. These sums can never be enough. Organisations cannot atone for the scale of the Atlantic slave trade. But for 200 years, we've been in denial, brushing this history under the carpet. And the idea that if you inherit wealth from this history, that along with that wealth, you also inherit some responsibility, that idea has been dismissed for decades.
Do you think it's going to go further into other institutions, into families who were in that position of doing very well from investments in or direct ownership of slaves and trade?
Lots of organisations and institutions are engaging in historical research, admitting and confronting their own history, and then deciding that they need to engage in some form of restorative justice. The University of Glasgow has done something similar. Lloyds of London are carrying out research into their history, the University of Cambridge, several universities in the United States, the Rowntree Foundation. There is a momentum here in which institutions themselves, not waiting for government, are deciding that if some of their wealth, their financial DNA comes from this world of slavery, or from crimes committed in the age of empire, that they need to engage with, and they need to acknowledge that with inherited wealth comes with inherited responsibility. Now, it's responsibility. It's not guilt or shame, which are, I think, very immature emotions in which to enter into a debate about history. But I think responsibility is the right word.
Historian David Olusoga talking to Michelle Hussain. French family doctors, or GPs, have taken to the streets to protest over pay and working conditions. Under the current system, GPs are paid per consultation, with many struggling to make ends meet. The strike comes amid a winter hospital crisis in France that's leaving patients without beds and rural areas in particular struggling. This report from our Paris correspondent, Lucy Williams.
In France, the bedside manner is reserved for patients. A national diagnosis requires bullhorns and whistles. GPs came out on strike this month to demand the government double their consultation fees and say they're working all hours to make ends meet.
I have to be a doctor, I have to be a secretary, I have to be my assistant, okay? So that means that I work 60 hours per week. We are upset and tired. I'm 52 years old and I'm realizing that I want to change my job.
It's not just GPs who are angry. 40% of nurses here want to leave their jobs, and a third of all medical students are quitting. Giulia Venturini is in her eighth year of a medical degree and is already questioning her decision.
I'm worried as a future doctor, but I'm worried as a patient too.
Hospitals here are sinking under a triple wave of winter viruses. The start of this year has been nicknamed Black January. Patients are sometimes treated in corridors for days.
On doit sortir de la tarification à l'activité.
President Macron has promised to change the way hospitals are funded, tying funds to health goals rather than the number of procedures carried out. The government also says it will look at GP charges, but easing pressures on medical staff won't fix France's growing problem of medical deserts. In Paris, you might get a GP appointment within a couple of hours. In Olliers, it can take 4 years. The last doctor here left in 2018.
La difficulté, c'est qu'on n'a pas eu de candidature.
No doctor wanted to come, the mayor Arnaud Provencher told me. In places like this, they're often the only medical service for miles. The French government has offered bonuses of 50,000 euros for GPs to move to medical deserts. It's also boosted hospital salaries. But the loss of medics from hospital wards or places like Olliers is France's most pressing health problem, and it won't be easy to cure.
That report by our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson. Towards the end of the 20th century, Morse code slowly disappeared, overtaken by more advanced forms of communication. But the distinctive tapping is being heard once again, thanks to a revival among amateur radio enthusiasts. Howard Bernstein from the Long Island CW Club in the US offers Morse code training. He spoke to my colleague Evan Davis, who said he thought it had all but disappeared.
Well, a lot of people thought that was the case, and we thought maybe it was going to diminish too. But there's been a resurgence of it. So people like to go out into the state parks and the national parks, and some like to go on top of mountains and operate. If you have a Morse code radio, the radios can be smaller, some as small as the size of a pack of cigarettes. Plus, you really don't need to drag along a computer. So if you're going to be walking some distance into a park, it would be much easier to have lightweight gear.
I'm going up a mountain. I've got my cigarette packet sized radio set to Morse code. Who the heck am I Morse coding to?
You know, there are hundreds and thousands of people worldwide still using this. So if you listen around on the ham radio frequencies, you'll hear people. There'll be people wanting to reach you.
I think we need to hear some Morse code, Howard. How quickly could you say good afternoon on Morse code?
Morse code is, Evan, is typically sent between 10 and 50 words a minute. So I have my Morse code key here set at 24 words a minute, and then I will just send to you right now, good afternoon, Evan. That's a very comfortable speed to receive for many experienced operators. I could slow this down and send that same thing. Well, that's the good and the afternoon.
Yeah, that's enough. We've got it. So it's not that slow. And how long does it take to become very comfortable with this code, actually?
If you took, let's say, two of our classes a week, and if you practiced 20 to 30 minutes a day, we would say within 3 or 4 months, the average person should be ready to get on the air and be able to use some of the skill that they're learning. To get up to the speeds that I was doing for you initially, that would take a couple of years of practice.
What's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because we've had a resurgence in people buying vinyl discs. There is a kind of a real desire sometimes to use these older technologies. It's got an appeal that the digital age can never quite match somehow.
You know, I believe that people are tiring of the immediacy of all the things at their fingertips and getting instant gratification. You know, Morse code has been around for quite some time, and it's a very romantic way to communicate. And as a matter of fact, learning Morse code and using it is good for exercising the brain, so it keeps your mind young.
Howard Bernstein talking to Evan Davis. A seal that's been trapped in a fishing lake in the southeast of England has evaded capture for more than a month while chomping its way through large quantities of fish. Experts say they believe the animal is refusing to leave because it's enjoying living in what amounts to its own well-stocked supermarket, as Helena Wilkinson reports.
The seal, barely a pup, spent much of today basking in the winter sunshine on an island in the middle of the fishing lake, looking relaxed and carefree. But over the past months, it's been causing havoc for anglers in what is a quiet reservoir, eating its way through more than $3,000 worth of fish. The reservoir is owned by the local council, but has been licensed to Nick North of Mark's Hall Fisheries for 11 years. He says it's had a huge effect on his business.
Devastated, I think, would be an understatement of what's happened. After all these years building it up, and then within a month to see it come crashing down, there's nothing I can do.
It's thought the seal made its way upstream along a nearby river in December. Since then, it's put on a good amount of weight, thanks to the abundance of fish on offer, including bream, carp and roach. James Bryan from the British Divers Marine Life Rescue said that the seal wasn't in a hurry to leave.
It's basically landed in a branch of Waitrose, hasn't it, really, and is working its way down the aisles. So I'm sure it's incredibly happy. It has a couple of injuries, and freshwater, while they're able to live in freshwater, isn't an ideal environment for them. They are colony social animals, so it should be back out in the estuary.
There have been two attempts to rescue the seal so far, but for now, the seal remains in the reservoir, much to the delight of locals, but not to the delight of fish.
Helena Wilkinson. And that is all from us for now. But before we go, a correction to a story we ran just before Christmas about a clash on the India-China border. We said that several Indian soldiers had been killed, but in fact, they were injured, thanks to our listener, Indrajit Bhattacharya, for pointing out the mistake. If you want to contact us about anything, and particularly your thoughts on Britain's place in the world 3 years on from Brexit, then email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Johnny Hall and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Introducing Self, a new show about real people who are challenging their relationship to money to build a better future for themselves.
My new focus is like, as these good things happen in my life, I want to be able to enjoy them.
Their loved ones.
Now, like, I really don't want my daughters out here wanting for nothing. Now it's kind of backfired because now they really don't have no respect for me.
And their communities.
I want to create more services where women can feel supported when they don't have support.
Self is live now with new episodes every Wednesday. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy January from HP. Save up to 65% during the Back to Business sale at HP.com. Live through January 14th. Shop online or work with our U.S.-based SMB sales experts to equip your business with the latest technology to drive speed and growth in 2023. Click on the link below or call 1-800-608-MYHP. Save an extra 17% on most business products by using promo code HPBusiness17. Exclusions apply. Act now.